accession number 28424, reel number 4.
Here it hands, reel 4. What happened after these contacts? What was the...
Oh, there was a follow-up insofar as you hoped you would catch up with somebody, but their escape drills were very finely honed, and on neither of the two occasions I've described was there any further contact at all.
How would you follow that? How would you do that following up? Would you just follow literally in the direction they've gone?
Yes, you would hope that you would see some evidence, but of course they split up. They would have a rendezvous arrangement. It might be days later in somewhere that they all knew and knew how to get to. The chance of finding two or three together would be, I think, next to nothing.
You'd had these two initial contacts, mm-hmm. which had proved fruitless in essence. What was the next sort of incident?
Well, the next was, in my case, the last. And it was part of a very major operation mounted not only by Suffolk's, but other regiments involved as well, Royal West Kent's for one. And it was an operation which had been planned to hunt this man, Lu Kong Kim, that I mentioned earlier. The information was that his current area of operation and hence his base was in an area of swamp in South Selangor, which was between KL and the coast. In fact, it was very nearly on the coast. The coast road and the beach were all that were between it and the sea. And the beach was historic. It was Morib Beach, where the Indian Division landed in 45 when we retook possession of the peninsula from the departing Japanese. And that beach was a very pleasant place to come home to at night and swim in the sea after a very hot, sticky, dirty day in the swamp. And so it befell that we undertook a series of patrols working on a compass only because there was nothing to see except the next bit of undergrowth in front of you. Visibility very, very small indeed. Underfoot, well, always ankle deep, sometimes worse. And the process was to march on a compass bearing from the road for X metres, do a right-hand turn or a left-hand turn, another X metres, same again, and with a little bit of luck you hope to hit the road again. Because in those circumstances you could get lost because there was no feature and you didn't know where you were. And we did this in tandem with lots of other patrols, and it was worked out in such a way that we crisscrossed, but not on the same day, so that you covered as much of this swamp area as you could. On day one of this operation, I went through this procedure, and on the first turn walked round a former bomb crater. It must have been wartime damage, I guess. Everything had, for some extraordinary reason, the growth hadn't taken place again, so it was a sort of large pond, really. And I walked round this because it was an obvious feature and there might have been some activity, but we saw nothing. So we continued on the compass march and got back to the road at the end of the day and went home and had a nice swim in the Indian Ocean and slept on the beach and repeated the exercise the following day. And what I'm going to do is read to you from Donald Mackay's excellent book, The Domino That Stood, quite the best thing that's ever been written about the Malayan Emergency, because he actually was, strange enough, a former friend and colleague from another existence, as it were, after the National Service period, and we'd worked together, indeed shared a flat together. And he wrote to me out of the blue and said, could I fill him in with details of this particular action? And unlike the rest of the book, what he did was to take my words and just put them in the book as I wrote to him. So I'll read you one short paragraph. It was only a few paces more to another larger clearing, which had a raised sleeping area with two people clearly visible, plus another walking on the other side, maybe 50 metres away. It was this target I fired at first, more in hope than anger, because the range was excessive in jungle terms. I missed, I think, but may have wounded, because my section corporal subsequently accounted for him. All this had taken me forward into the clearing and towards the sleeping area, from which two people ran across my front and away from me. The range was now 20 or 30 metres. I dropped the first, a girl with a 410 shotgun, and fired at the sound of movement in front of me, finally catching up with Lu Kong Kim, who was draped over a very large tree trunk and clearly in extremis. It was a typical action, and it happened very quickly, and probably only one or two of the section actually saw and engaged a target.
With some elements there, it seems to show that your reactions were quite honed at that stage to very quick,
yep,
lightning,
yep,
actions taking,
yep,
place.
Yep. That's so. We knew who we were looking for. We knew that he was to be found somewhere there. Not necessarily we would be successful in finding him, but we knew. And the time involved, the visibility being what it was, the underfoot conditions being so difficult to move quickly, you had to be absolutely on the ball. Otherwise, nothing would have happened at all, and this was a successful action simply by virtue of the surprise.
It's interesting as well, because obviously within that group there, there was a female member of that. How common was female aid or help or membership of the CT groups?
I imagine the girl was his mistress. I doubt if she was a committed communist.
And what were you armed with at that? Was that the carbine?
Carbine.
How did that perform in that environment? Was it something that would be good at range, or did it have good stopping power?
Yes, it was an ideal weapon for the jungle. If there was a criticism, it would be a criticism of how it was used rather than the weapon itself. But a high rate of fire, and because it had no wood on it, very light, and therefore what I believe technically is called the throw-off, was excessive. So if I was aiming at someone at the bottom of the garden, which would have been about probably the maximum range I could have seen or heard any movement, the first shot would be waist high, and the second might well be over his head. So it was important to keep the bursts at limited duration. Going back to something I said earlier about that crater that I walked around, when we followed up, because of course you never know, another guy wounded behind the next tree, we actually came out on the other side of that crater, so I had walked within paces of this camp the day before. Something else, again, about surprise, which is significant, and it's also in this chapter of Donald Mackay's book. Again, if I may just read a little bit of it. During that day, Han's patrol passed very close to Lu Kong Kim's camp without knowing it, and without disturbing Lu either. an interesting sidelight on the difficulties of operating in such conditions. On July 6, Hans went on with the same pattern of search, marching on a compass bearing for 1,000 yards or so, then turning through a right angle and marching for what he hoped was another 1,000 yards, or perhaps two, before turning again through a right angle and setting off once more. It sounds a rough and ready way of going about things, and would not have been used if the ground had been better, but experience had taught that it was the only technique that had any chance of being effective in featureless, largely unmapped terrain, where visibility over 10 yards was good, and progress at 1,000 yards an hour was fast moving. Early in the afternoon, Hans made his last turn, which he hoped would take him back towards the road, and almost immediately found himself in an unoccupied clearing with an Attap hut. The hut was set on fire with a phosphorus grenade, an activity which for some reason was not noticed by Lukon Kim or his gang. Hans' account goes on, and that was the bit I read to you earlier. So again, we were within feet of this camp, and how the noise of that phosphorus grenade exploding was not heard, I can now answer. They had a radio, a commercial radio, tuned in to a local Chinese station, playing music.
Equally then, with the way that the noise is in the jungle, you couldn't hear the Chinese music.
No,
then.
No.
In many respects, then, what you seem to be describing there is it's even with the crisscrossing of that, the camp could have been missed.
Oh yes, yes, yeah.
Very, very
absolute easy. Fluke. I could. We destroyed this. It was a jungle dormitory. This building. It was built on stilts. Could have slept 10 or 12 men. And the ground around it was cleared, and it was on one of the infrequent sort of dry patches in the swamp, so it was an obvious place for this, and unoccupied. There was a ladder, and I shinned up the ladder and had a look around. The place was absolutely bare. In went the phosphorus grenade, bang, woof, smoke, it burnt. And off we went. Look at the compass again. Okay, this way, guys. And then suddenly this. So, yes, no, could have been missed. Could have been easily missed.
Once the action had occurred, what was your role then? Because obviously you had a number of fatalities. What did you have to do? Did you have to identify these people?
Well, the Lukon Kim himself could have been identified by more or less any member of the regiment. He remarkable for Chinese had a beard, and so we all knew exactly what he looked like, and there was no question about who we had. Now, yes, what happened? Well, the first thing you have to do is ensure that you haven't hit somebody else who is wounded, or maybe you haven't hit them, and they're, as I say, behind the next tree. So there's a big fanning out operation, and careful looking for tracks, which of course are easy in the swamp even for unskilled trackers. Nobody. Meantime, the radio business had to be gone through to inform, in this case, the commanding officer, because he was in charge of the operation, who was on the roadside in a command vehicle. Of course, the very first person who needed to be told what had happened. And then, so we had to go through this radio business, setting up the aerial and so on, getting the signal through. So I made a report, and the unpleasant and difficult part of the job was then to remove the bodies, which were carried on poles. And was extremely hard work. We weren't that far in, actually, so it wasn't too far to go. I was instructed that one of my fellow platoon commanders, who was also doing this cross-work patrolling, probably not more than 2,000 yards away, was told, and of course they had heard the firing, so at least they had something to go for, that they were to remain on site and ambush the camp overnight, whilst we carried the bodies out and reported in more detail on the action, which is what we did. And then we, that was the end of the day's work, and we, again, were on the beach and in the sea. Now the next day, I was required to be at the exit point on the road. I took a half section with me, and the reason I had to be there was to guide in an SAS wing, unit, I don't know how they describe themselves, a lot of the chaps who were going to be in for quite some weeks on an intensive sweep of the entire swamp area. The expression on all our faces was one of total disbelief when these guys got off the lorry. They were carrying so much gear, including the kitchen sink. But then they were going in for some weeks, and you know, there was a requirement for this. But what would have happened in the event of action? It's very difficult to imagine when carrying all that stuff. By this time, of course, the route from the road to the camp looked a bit like the M4 on a bad day, because everything had been flattened and it was a sort of standing water, you know. So I took them in, and there was no problem finding the way. Relieved my colleague and his patrol who were there and led them out again. And that, in fact, for me, was the end of the action, because I was very near to coming home time anyway. And I think that where it was the last time I was in the jungle.
In the aftermath of an operation like that,
mm-hmm.
was there much emphasis then placed, because obviously you carried the bodies out, of formal identification of these people?
Yes, but that would be a police job.
Was there any feedback to yourself, obviously, of the importance of who you'd...
Oh, well, this man was a legend. A very unpleasant legend. No question that we had removed public enemy number one. No argument.
And subsequently, were you awarded some kind of decoration?
Yes, I was awarded Military Cross some months later.
Was that a surprise, obviously, because you've been doing much of this jungle work for such a long time?
Total, yeah. And as National Servicemen, we spent relatively short time on the job, inevitably with the fact that the entire period of service of 2 years, in which more or less half that was taken in training and troopship time, you know, so there were several very successful and decorated regular officers in the regiment who had been at it much, much longer and had much, much more experience. So yes, great surprise, a great honour, of course.
Could I have some kind of general questions mm-hmm. about your service in Malaya? What was the kind of relationship that you had with the regular officers as a national service officer? How was it in the Southern Regiment?
Completely free and open, and yeah, I mean, we were all doing the same job in the same regimental ethos, proud to be doing it, and we were all colleagues on an equal footing, other than the rank situation. Which for lieutenants and second lieutenants was not a consideration under those circumstances. Whether it might be in others, I don't know. No. There's no boundaries were drawn at all.
And also, I wonder if you could tell me something a little about the reputation that the Suffolks gained during the Malayan campaign, because they were very active, weren't they, over this?
Yes. I can't quote you any statistics as to kills and other successful actions, but yes, they had a very, very solid reputation within the colonial community, and highly respected as such for what they had achieved. And naturally, one was very proud to be part of that whole sort of family.
And where had the bulk of the unit been recruited from? Was it from Suffolk, or was it from the whole of East Anglia?
I should think that my platoon at any one time was probably 50% local and probably 50% northeast London-ish, so Essex, if you like.
Is there any characteristics of those types of people that made them suited for the kind of warfare that you were involved in?
They were just a completely random selection of 19-year-olds who were all doing the same thing and received the same training and did the same job day in, day out, and got along together pretty well as far as I was aware.
You mentioned earlier sitting in an ambush where the ants were.
Yeah.
How often would you be in the ambush situation?
It depended, again, on information. The night ambush arrangement was usually in the early hours of the evening and night, when it was known that the supply people, because the bandits had their own supply network, who were not actually usually in the jungle but carried either messages or food and equipment from wherever it could be stolen. And these chaps had regular routes, and it was known sometimes exactly where those routes were. What was not known is when they were going to be used. But sometimes even that information was available, and when it was, these routes, which would be tracks leading into the jungle, would be ambushed at night. That means to say, going in at last light, 7-ish in the evening, and usually coming out about midnight, because experience, I think, had taught that there was no movement much later in the night. But whether that was always the case, I don't know. I didn't do too many myself. They were extremely uncomfortable periods of non-activity. And on no occasion when I was involved, excuse me, any form of contact at all. But some of them were successful indeed, yeah.
Another point that I was thinking about earlier on was you mentioned on the 3-day patrols.
Yeah.
What kind of physical condition were you in after sort of 3 days in the jungle?
Well, we were very young and very fit. And when you got back to base and you went through the normal routine of dismissing the patrol, arms inspection, removing your clothes as quick as you possibly could and getting into the shower, and putting on something dry and clean, and talking to your fellow officers if they were in camp, and then it was beer and supper and bed, but you didn't feel any different, you know, you were just used to it, it's what you did.
What happened, obviously, after your last engagement in the period? Was that a period of winding down then and returning to the UK?
Well, I was rather fated. Fated in the sense of being well looked after. And I was... it's very, very kind of those concerned, other than the commanding officer initiative, of course. I was sent for a sort of long weekend to Penang, which then as now was a desirable place to be. Very old colonial holiday town, I suppose you'd say. And I was to stay with the British resident, which was very enjoyable, and then with a local English family in the business community there. So that was very enjoyable interlude. Again, total surprise. I couldn't think what I'd done to deserve it, really. And then it was back to Kajang, train to Singapore, and back on the Empire Windrush. Only this time on D-deck. Not so good.
Really, one last kind of question then. How do you feel now about having served with the Suffolk Regiment during the Millennium?
Well, looking back, hugely proud, of course, as any of us were. It was unforgettable and always will be unforgettable. And as it happened, it ended very successfully. And just to return to Donald Mackay's book, he called it The Domino That Stood, and what he meant was that whilst the rest of Southeast Asia was turning pink to red very rapidly, Malaya did not do so and achieved independence and then subsequently split with Singapore in a completely peaceful way, and that was a huge tribute to the British Army in general who had brought this about.
I believe that you had a visit from General Templer the day after the action.
Yes, that's true. And again, quoting from Donald Mackay's book, this is the note that he published about that meeting. It was also typical of Templer that he took the trouble the next day to visit B Company 1 Suffolk in its camp at Moray Beach to congratulate Hans in person. When he arrived, Hans was asleep, wearing only a sarong, and remembers trying to conduct a suitably deferential conversation with the great man whilst periodically having to clutch the sarong to prevent a complete loss of dignity.